Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 475th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta, and that is where we found this person on the street who is willing to come in and talk about restless legs.
Restless to talk about restless legs. So that's
and if either of you were very clever, you'd have said we're going to talk about Willis Ekbom disease.
Oh wow, James!
Yeah, I know. I can Google.
That's it.
I can Google.
It's March. It's March 11th, and you're already done for the year.
Exactly. So anyway, much easily understood as restless legs syndrome.
That's right.
So why don't we
Tina has to introduce herself.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tina. I'm how rude of me. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. As Mike alluded to, I'm a very important person on walking the streets of Edmonton. My name
Lost.
Is I am the director here. I'm a family physician and I work at the university doing stuff like this.
So I thought it might be worth just having a quick mention of what restless leg syndrome is, because I don't know if everybody would know exactly what it is. And again, I can Google this. So it's just really a condition that causes uncontrollable urge to move your legs, usually because of some sort of a uncomfortable or strange sensation. And most of the time, I think you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, most of the time it occurs during the evening or when you're sleeping. And it can be quite, I don't know if debilitating is the right word, but it can be quite disconcerting to a lot of people.
Yeah, yes, it does.
I think your Google search has done you well.
Yes.
I would agree with that. And in practice, important to distinguish, say, from nocturnal muscle cramps, which can be a bit different. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's not that, you know, it sounds like it should be super easy to distinguish between those, but sometimes it's a bit more complex in history. Yeah, it's not that easy.
Yeah. So why don't we, we just recently did it. And when I say we, I mean the universal universal we, not me.
The royal we.
Yeah. The royal we. We just did a tools for practice about 3 or 4 months ago on a particular agent for restless leg syndrome. And Tina, you did this with Roger Craig, I think.
Yeah, I did it with Roger Craig and Michael Wolin, who are both medical students at the University of Alberta.
Cool.
So they did the lion's share of the work. They did a really great job on this. And, I supervised.
Yeah. So why don't you let them? So what did they find, or what did you guys find?
All right. So the question was, what is the evidence for pramipexol in the treatment of restless leg syndrome? We came up with that question just because restless leg syndrome isn't something we'd seen a lot of evidence around, and we're just sort of curious. It had come up in discussion before. And this agent is actually a great example, if you were going to teach evidence-based medicine, of an agent that has multiple randomized controlled trials that show similar evidence of effect. So what we found is a systematic review of 12 randomized controlled trials with over 3,000 patients, and the average age of those patients was about 50 to 58 years of age. And they were randomized to pramipexol, low dose of 0.125 up to 1.5 milligrams per day, versus placebo, and looked at outcomes related to restless leg. And what's great about this metagraph is when you look at it, all the trials show similar evidence of benefit. They're all on the same side of effectiveness, so we felt fairly certain that this was reliable evidence. And so what kind of outcomes do you look at when you talk about restless legs? So one that we liked was the number of patients who say that they have improved symptoms. So that would be defined as very much better or much better. And if you look at pramipexol compared to placebo, that number was about 63% who said they were better compared to 41% in the placebo group. So that's a number needed to treat of 5. Again, interesting, the placebo response rate there is about 40%.
But really important to know, right? Because it just tells you how the natural fluctuation of the condition.
Absolutely.
And that if a person responds, it's likely not the drug, which is the tricky nuance around it. But that's why it's so important to know those sort of 60 versus 40% numbers. But they also had different ways of reporting it as well.
Yeah, exactly. So that was our favorite outcome, just mm-hmm. how many people say they're getting better. There's also different scores, of course. You can look at the International Restless Leg Score, which I had never used clinically in my practice, but doing research.
Oh, come on. You do every day.
That's right. Well, Mike Allen was my preceptor, remember. And so
oh, that's true. Yeah, so that you didn't get much from that, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you taught me nothing of this. But... percent or greater reduction in that scale. The pramipexole group was 62% compared to 38% in placebo. So very similar numbers, yeah. Actually, combinated to treat a five. So the evidence around its effectiveness, at least short term, is very good, very convincing, I would say. We were really curious about dosing because there are certainly different trials that look at different doses. And as you proclaim all the time, James, low dose is always better. So we wanted to see the evidence around that. So when those trials that looked at dosing, they had all sorts of different outcomes that they reported. But one that we could find consistent was the patient global impression of improvement. So again, much or very much better. And you know what was interesting? It was similar for a number of doses. So for the 0.25 milligram dose, about 73% said they thought they were better compared with the 0.5 milligram dose, which was 77-ish%. And the 0.75 milligram dose was actually a bit lower. So these results weren't statistically significantly different comparatively, but we thought it was really interesting when you look, the higher doses don't always seem to have better outcomes. Yeah.
And that's a fairly consistent finding with most things. What's interesting is I know that you can get slightly lower doses of this drug than that, but you know, just because we know that 0.25 works doesn't mean, you know, 0.125 might give her an effect, or even half of that might give an effect as well. So it's always interesting, but a great example of how a drug will always come on the market without having us really know what the right dose is, at least to sort of start with, which is why, as you mentioned, Tina, I'm always pushing to start with very relatively low doses.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't mm-hmm. it? We have a drug we're using, and nobody really knows the optimal dose or what we should be doing.
Yeah, and you never know for an individual anyway, which is, again, going back to, we've got the evidence, then how do you put it into practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were also curious about adverse events with regards to this drug, and not surprisingly, they were not well reported in many of the trials, and a lot of the trials reported all sorts of different adverse events and were of varying durations, but what we could find some consistency for was nausea. So 8 trials reported on that with over 2,000 patients. And nausea was about 14% of the pramipexole group versus 5% of placebo, with a number needed to harm of 13. And actually, I found that one, to be honest, I didn't know that was a side effect before. So maybe that just speaks to my inadequacies.
But no, again, that was your preceptor.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'd like to remind you that while some people say that the truth can be helpful, it can also be quite hurtful.
Oh, sorry. We'll edit that out. No, we won't.
Yeah, okay. No, yeah, no, just like, yeah.
Right. So, and the other side effect of fatigue, which is interesting in a medication we're using at nighttime. So, I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, we can decide how important you think that is. So 6 trials reported on that, and the pramipexole group reported a 10% of this versus placebo 6%, number needed to harm of 23. So actually, I think that was sometimes daytime fatigue as well, just to mm-hmm. be clear on that. So, we did not find a statistically significant difference in dizziness or headache compared to placebo. So that was somewhat interesting, yeah. I suppose.
And you know, it's hard to know. Again, there's probably a dose related effect for those sorts of things. Obviously, if you don't give it, you don't get those side effects, at least not above placebo. And so, again, another reason to probably start with, you know, relatively lower doses to see if it has an effect.
You're really riding that horse today.
Tina started this. I was going to go the entire podcast without mentioning it, but she jumped right in.
We both know that's a lie.
No, she did. Go back and listen to the podcast. She started it off.
Sorry, I drifted off.
I know. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, Mike is on high doses of Pramipexol.
So my restless mind syndrome.
Yeah, for real. It's a restless annoyance syndrome. So, what, Tina, why don't you keep us going on this with a bit sort of a context, because that's always the key thing. We've got this single drug that's being looked at, but where do we, like, what do we, how do we think about it?
So, you know what I found the most interesting about looking at this drug was this whole issue around augmentation. Mm-hmm. And again, what does augmentation mean? Augmentation is a paradoxical sort of worsening of symptoms. And I just found this super, super fascinating. So there's a lot of evidence or studies that have tried to look at this, because as it turns out, some of these dopamine agents will cause this paradoxical worsening over time. And what I think is the most fascinating is that, so how would that present? It may present with worsening of symptoms. It may present with you developing symptoms earlier in the night, or the medication wearing off before morning. And every article you read will acknowledge, yeah, but that, you know, it's hard to figure out if that's augmentation or they just need an increase in dose, or they're not being optimally treated. And so there's all sorts of different, and this wasn't in the tool per se, but all sorts of different scales to, or, you know, criteria to help you to identify if this is augmentation. But I found this fascinating and actually somewhat tricky. So if you look at the studies that report augmentation, the best evidence that we could kind of find says that under a year, maybe 8% of people will develop this. But the longer you're on it, the more likely you are to develop this. So that at a year or greater, the best evidence we found for pramipexol was about 42% of patients may develop this. Which really makes it tricky, because most of these patients, it's not a short, you know, restless legs, isn't it?
It's a lifetime thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't know, there's really, you're right. I mean, it's almost impossible to figure out whether it's worsening because of the drug or because it's getting worse and the drug is not working. like, and I don't think you can. But I would imagine the approach I would take is you just require constant reassessment of this, because if you're going to start the drug and they get better, your next task would be to get them on the lowest dose, or at least to even maybe just stop it again and see if it comes back. Because look at the placebo group response. I mean, you know, that's 40%. That's impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And we said it. Generally, you know, people will have a lifetime of symptoms, but for others, there is sort of this episodic worsening. Mm-hmm. It gets better on its own, right? This almost like a relapsing, remitting type of presentation. So, yeah, so maybe you have trials of drug holidays. And then again, a good reminder that low dose, because it seems that the longer you're on it and the higher the dose, the more likely you are to develop that augmentation.
Yeah. But there's also other sort of non-pharmacological treatments that can be used.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. So, obviously, if someone presents with restless leg symptoms, the trial of the non-pharmacologic options should probably be first, especially given the complexities with some of these treatments that we're looking at. So there's some evidence, again, not great, but some evidence supporting exercise, some evidence looking around compression devices, or even a little bit on standard acupuncture. And I didn't look into that too much, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But and then this idea of lifestyle changes, you know, so has there been increase in alcohol use or decreased mobility, things that may be making it worse? One of our colleagues, Scott Garrison, he's looked a lot at sort of muscle cramps and what have you, but, he was big on reminding me, you know, the whole issue of iron, remembering to, you know, guidelines will say, even if your ferritin is less than 50 or less than 75, which would still be considered sort of normal, maybe you should consider supplementation, with iron. Again, as an initial treatment before you start sort of pharmacotherapies.
And we can make a nice link to the last podcast that we just did, which is all about
how to replace your iron.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'll be, it'll make a lot of sense now that you, if you go back and have a listen to that one, but,
did you recommend IV iron for everyone?
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah, no, yeah. We could just get people to sit in a vat of iron.
Yeah. Absorb.
Yeah,
dermally. Mm-hmm. Apply it dermally.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's lots of drugs. What about drugs that can make this worse, though? That would be another thing to avoid, right? And that should play right into James's hands.
I'm not going to mention it.
Once she's done, you can get, you can tilt at windmills again.
Words can hurt, Mike.
As I found out today.
I just wanted to throw this in here. I was listening to a podcast you guys did a little while ago, and what I was really appreciating about it was James's stories of the times long ago. How
thanks.
Things used to be done.
Is this the one about Socrates again? Is his buddy Socrates?
Yeah. No. Yeah. He was one of my students.
The whippersnapper.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't sure about him, but he made a name for himself.
He seemed to work out.
Yeah. So back to the subject at hand, what are the things that can worsen restless leg syndrome?
Right. So drugs that may worsen it. And, you know, these are listed in some of the guidelines, things like antihistamines, dopamine receptor blockers, or some of the serotonergic antidepressants. So, I guess if your patient's on an antidepressant, I mean, you can consider those things, and it again, it's a bit of common sense, right? But this idea of lifestyle changes, exercise, and then what drugs are they on that could be making this worse? And those would all be much, much better first line than the pramipexole, which we put the tool on. Mm-hmm. But we certainly have some patients who just have this residual problem, and it does seem to benefit patients, at least in the short term.
And I think it's a good reminder that any drug that affects any receptor can basically cause any symptoms. That's it is very tricky, and I think that it's important to get people off of medications first, and especially if you can get sort of a time thing. I think we've talked about this in the past, Mike, with the timing of things, but even sometimes it can be weeks to months of being on a drug before you get a certain side effect slash symptom. So these things are always tricky. And then Tina throws in the whole concept of augmentation, which makes it even more confusing. And so, but it really shows the importance of doing things in a systematic approach and getting the patient to basically tell you if it's working, not the other way around.
Not to tell them that they're fine.
Yeah, exactly.
You're doing much better, and you nod heavily while you're saying this. You're doing much better.
Yeah. So the sort of evidence behind this allows us to just talk about all sorts of different, nuances of how you then use that evidence and put it into context. But they're all the messages that we've been doing for, back around the time of Socrates.
Absolutely.
So anything else you guys want to bring up about this?
No, I think Tina hit it. There's a lot of challenges with this condition. Mm-hmm. It's the making the diagnosis should be easier than it is. But in my experience, maybe it's just, as Tina pointed out, a terrible teacher and clinician. I found it hard at times to sort out cramping and trying to sort out the difference for patients than a cramp in the sense that they have to move their legs. And it can get quite tricky. And then many of the medications can, I remember one of the things we used to give were TCAs, and that actually can cause this condition. Mm-hmm. That was very long ago, but the wise words of a teacher were TCAs, they work for anything when you need sleep. And it turns out that they could exacerbate this condition. So I think it's all of the things Tina was mentioning. And then it is good news that the evidence is solid, at least for this, that the results are consistent. And mm-hmm. it doesn't seem to matter how you look at it, 60% versus 40% is the number that get better over placebo.
Yeah, no, it's cool. So anything else you want to add, Mike? Do you want to? Anything you need to sell?
Oh, and we have, yes, James, thank you for reminding me. We have CFPC Learn now available. If you'd like to sign on at any time, we're just arranging having the podcast also moved into CFPC Learn, but it has podcasts, webinars, instructional design courses that are kind of interactive. It has the Jeopardy type style of learning. We call it Choose Your Briefs, if you've seen us do that at presentations before. So there's lots of great content on there, including tools for practice, and we encourage you to check it out.
Yeah. Now, just to make sure, we're going to move some of the podcasts on there. You'll still be able to get them all via the website and all that sort of stuff, just exactly the way you've been doing it. But we're hoping to link them in with getting education credits and all that sort of stuff. So people need that to be able to get licensed and all those good things.
Maintain their license.
Maintain it. Sure. Yeah. Anything else, Tina, or are we good?
Yeah, no, I think that's a brief summary of a complex condition, disorder managed.
Great job by you and Roger and Michael and all that. And we just get all the glory. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.